Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraic Reedy, Richard Saunderson, and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. Hi and welcome to another Little Atoms, this week with me, Neil Denny. And tonight's show features a conversation I recorded earlier this week with the film director Vadim Jean. Vadim is probably best known for the film Leon the Pig Farmer and the Terry Pratchett adaptations Hogfather and The Colour of Magic. But in this show we talk about his upcoming film In the Land of the Free. In the Land of the Free is a documentary feature narrated by Samuel L. Jackson that examines the story of Herman Wallace, Albert Woodfox and Robert King. They are known as the Angola Three and have spent almost a century between them in solitary confinement in Angola, the Louisiana State Penitentiary in the USA. Herman and Albert are still currently held in solitary confinement after 36 years. The film is released today, March the 26th, and can be seen at the Apollo Piccadilly Circus and the Ritzy at Brixton, and on various nights next week at the Curzon Soho, the Clapham Picture House, the Islington Screen on the Green, Edinburgh Cameo, Glasgow Film Theatre, Southampton Harbour Lights, and the Curzon Wimbledon. I'll just say one thing about the sound quality of this interview. It was recorded with me on the telephone and Vadim on his mobile, first of all walking along Charing Cross Road, then getting in a taxi to Euston Station, then buying a ticket, then buying a coffee, then finding his seat on a train to Manchester. So there's quite a bit of ambient noise and various announcements. But nonetheless, Vadim coped admirably with all of these distractions, and I hope you enjoy the interview.
Vadim, welcome to Little Atoms. Thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure.
We're going to be talking about your new film, In the Land of the Free. So perhaps you could, first of all, very briefly tell us what it's about.
In the Land of the Free is the story of three men who are known as the Angola Three. They've spent between them over a century in solitary confinement in a prison called Angola in Louisiana in America for crimes that many people don't believe they committed. And it's a story that examines these remarkable men, really, about the triumph of the human spirit in the face of the worst adversity you can think of.
Let's talk about how did you first come about the story of the Angola Three, then?
Well, I made a documentary series with Anita Roddick, the lady who founded The Body Shop with Gordon, her husband. And Anita and I became great friends, and as a consequence, she kept telling me about the case of the Angola Three, because since 2001, she'd been with her husband, Gordon, funding their lawyers. So the first time, really, they had proper legal representation. And so I knew about the case, but didn't think I could do anything. And then, when she very sadly passed away in 2007 at her memorial, one of the Angola Three, who was released in 2001, Robert King, came and spoke. And what he said in front of 3,000 people at Westminster Central Hall was so powerful and so full of actually dignity and poignancy. And in particular, he played two telephone messages from Herman and Albert from solitary, which was basically a eulogy to Anita, I mean, to her, what she'd done for them, really. And it made me realise just how special they were, and it was very sort of emotional. Anita's big thing was, just do something. You know, she would say, I don't care why you're doing it, whatever your reasons are, whether it's just from kindness or ego or whatever it is, but just do something. It was like her big finger pointing down to me saying, Vadim, what you've got to do is make a film about the Angola Three. And we, as Anita would have wanted, we marched on Shell House, all of us who were at the memorial across Westminster Bridge. And I remember being on the middle of Westminster Bridge, and I'd gone with David Abraham, the chief executive of UK TV, who commissioned the documentary series I made with Anita. And I said, I've got to make the film. And the following day, he rang me up and says, OK, what do I have to do? And that was how it started. It was really to my desire to make the film that got the ball rolling. And And then the rest of the money came from my regular movie producer, Paul Brooks, who, as soon as he heard the story, said, what can I do to help? And between David and Paul, they made the film happen.
Okay, well, let's talk about a little bit more about the background of the three men. So there's yeah. Robert King, who is... The story is slightly separate from the other two, and yeah, is the one that's yeah. now free. But the two men that are still currently incarcerated, Herbert Wallace and Albert Woodfox. So let's talk about their actual backgrounds, why they were there in the first place, I suppose.
Well, they were young African-Americans in late 60s, very poor upbringings, and they ended up being involved in petty crime. And Herman, I think, was the more serious of them in that sense. And they all ended up, Herman and Albert, ended up in prison with unbelievably long sentences because sentencing was very harsh in those days in America for robbery. So they were serving long sentences in the New Orleans Parish Prison in the late 1960s. Where they basically got mixed together with the Black Panthers, because the prison authorities then were very frightened of the civil rights movement known as the Black Panthers, who were quite radical activists for African-American human rights, you know, most famously represented by the two sprinters at the Mexico Olympic, who gave the black glove salute on the podium. Well, this is right in that era. And what the New Orleans Parish Prison authorities tried to do was to, I suppose, divide and rule or kind of conquer the threat that they regarded from the Black Panthers by throwing them into the same bits of the prison as black gangsters in the hope that they'd kind of cancel each other out. So these two young guys, Herman Wallace and Albert Woodfox, who, you know, they would have labelled black gangsters, you know, who were in prison for robbery, got thrown in with a bunch of Black Panthers, and they ended up becoming politicised. They were really impressed that for the first time, as I think Albert says in the film, you know, the first time he actually saw black Americans who would stand up, you know, against the racism and the treatment. And so that's where they began. So basically, they got thrown into prison. They got thrown together with a bunch of Black Panthers, and Herman and Albert were really impressed and actually became Black Panthers. So that when they were moved to Angola prison in the middle of Louisiana, they started a chapter of the Black Panthers in Angola prison, because at that time, Angola prison was the bloodiest prison in America. There were inmate guards, terrible trade in new young prisoners, you know, be abused by the older prisoners. And they fought against that and many other abuses of human rights in the prison.
So that was going on, basically. Although, as you said, there were like trustees, which were the prison guards who were also inmates. But clearly this yes. was obviously going on with the cooperation of the prison authorities.
Yes, yes. There are recorded instances of inmates taking out their personal grudges with the shotgun that they were given to look after the other inmates at that point. We're talking sort of early 70s, mm-hmm. 1970, 69, 70. It's a terrible place. Regularly, prisoners would report of people sewing up their own wounds from knife fights on their cell benches. It was a brutal, terrible place where there weren't enough guards and there wasn't enough money, where prisoners would eat their food from trays on the floor outside their cells because there was no slot to put the food through. And so one of the things that Herman and Albert did was the 48-day hunger strike, just to get the authorities to agree to cut a slot in the prison cell doors so that they wouldn't have to eat their food off the floor. These guys are highly intelligent, very strong men, and they wouldn't have the foot of the prison authorities on their necks. They wouldn't just lie there and take it. That came from their belief in the program that the Black Panthers espoused.
So these guys were already in prison for yep. what seems ridiculously long sentences for the petty crimes that they had committed. But then there is the incident, which is the sort of central point of this film, really, which is the murder of Brent Miller, one of the prison yeah. guards.
Yeah.
So what happens now?
So one of the problems in the prison was there weren't really enough, in 1972, enough guards for the number of inmates. I think there were 5,000 inmates on an 18,000-acre ex-slave plantation. So you can imagine how spread out these guys are.
Sure.
And I think on the morning of the murder, Brent would have been responsible for something like 90 to 100 prisoners. They'd all gone off to breakfast, and he was murdered in one of the dormitories, in one of the blocks of dormitories where the prisoners were kept. And Herman, Albert, and two other men were accused of that murder. And in what I think many of us believe was a rush to judgment, the prisoner authorities decided they had their men within 3 or 4 days of the investigation. And the people they accused were all what they called black militants.
So to what extent do you think that is an element in this? Do you think the political, you know, the political aspects of that coloured the judgment?
I think when you one of the reasons I made this film was, you know, I didn't just take Anita's word for it. You know, absolutely believed 100% that if she was behind it, then there had to be, it had to be true. But I still wanted to, assure myself that on the basis of the evidence, that this was a case that I could, I knew I'd be spending a year of my life on it, and I had to make sure that it was a case that I believed in entirely and 100%. So I read all the trial transcripts. When you read the transcripts of Albert's trial in particular, it's full of obfuscation, it's full of racist overtones, of, descriptions of that panther shit by guards. The overtones and undertones of it are that there's almost a sense at some point in the trial transcripts where you feel like the prosecution are just painting them as black racist agitators who basically wanted to kill a white prison guard because of their beliefs. That was how they were portrayed. And I think, it's really clear. It's actually kind of, it's almost, transparent. And you would never be allowed the things that they say in that, the things that they say in that court transcript in this country. I really don't believe. And what becomes clear is that you read the trial transcripts and you think, okay, these guys, they wanted somebody for this. A prison guard had not been killed in that prison for, I think, 38 years, something like that, nearly 40 years. And they wanted one of these black militants to pay the price. As evidenced by one of them, he had been nowhere near the scene of the crime, was inserted into the case by the prison authorities because they wanted to make the point that one of a particular group of black militants that had been released from solitary confinement 2 weeks before was one of the perpetrators. Because there was a division in the prison authorities between the old kind of redneck, old school prison guards and new professional correctional officers who'd been brought in by the state of Louisiana to sort out the problems of Angola. And there was deep resentment. And what happened 2 weeks before the murder was that the new guard found that there were 17, I think, black militants in solitary confinement for no reason at all, with no paperwork, and against the kind of regulations that the new guard had brought in. In other words, what the new guard was saying was, you can't just throw these guys inside, there's got to be a reason for it. And these 17 prisoners were released. And the new guard, when the murder happened, pointed to one of those 17 and said, look, you see, it's these new correctional officers coming in, it's their fault. And so they inserted this guy, and his case was immediately thrown out. Well, they effectively did the same with Herman and Albert. They weren't among that 17, but the prison authorities targeted them, in my view, because they were trying to stop the sexual slavery that was going on in the prison, and they were difficult. They weren't just going to sit there and take it. The consequence of that was that there was a rush to judgment, and one of the most important things that happened was that one of the older prisoners, a man called Hezekiah Brown, who was a serial rapist into life, who at first said that he knew nothing about the crime, a few days later was pulled from his cell in the middle of the night, sat down by the prison authorities and said it was Wallace and Woodfox. They did it, and if you testify that that's the case, we promise you your freedom and a carton of cigarettes a week. And the original all-white juries that convicted Herman and Albert had no idea that that had happened.
What's interesting is, the case pretty much rests on that one person's evidence.
Yeah.
At that time when the trial first happened, but interestingly, at subsequent appeals, that same thing has happened. One rather unreliable prisoner's evidence has...
Yes, but Herman and Albert were convicted on the basis of one person's testimony, and that's Hezekiah Brown. Promised his freedom in return for testifying, a carton of cigarettes a week, which is currency in prison, and removed immediately to the safest, lowest security part of the prison. When Albert got a retrial in 1998, Hezekiah Brown had passed away, and one of the reasons why Albert's conviction was overturned in September 2008 was that the assistant prosecutor from the first trial in 73 was called as a character witness for the then-dead Hezekiah Brown. Now, in Judge Brady's report in 2008, the report, that the judgment that overturned Albert's conviction, that was described as egregious prosecutorial misconduct, because there's a Supreme Court judgment that says you can't have a prosecutor be a character witness for anybody, alive or dead, because the jury will take the view that that's the view of the state. So that's what they've been up against. They've been haunted, really, by the evidence of this liar, a known prison switch. They've been prosecuted on the testimony of a known prison snitch. And one of the things that's interesting that Gordon Roddick says, and he's quite right, is a number of prisoners come into a dormitory where there is a lone prison officer and one other prisoner, They murder their prison officer and they leave one of the best known snitches in the prison alive. They leave him there to testify against them? I don't think so. And no defence lawyer in those early trials ever raised that question. Why would they not ask Hezekiah Brown? You know, why do you think they left you? And there's so many questions that weren't asked by the defence lawyers in those early trials that make you realise that they were never properly represented, that they were convicted on the evidence of a liar, and a liar who was basically bribed by the prison authorities to give his testimony. I mean, that would never stand up, you would hope, even in an American court today. And it's a disgraceful stain on the character of the legal system in Louisiana that the Attorney General's office is still using the evidence of Hezekiah Brown to try and keep Herman and Albert in prison.
You're listening to Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Vadim Zhin about his film In the Land of the Free. So, Vadim, let's talk a little bit about the actual process of making the film. Did you meet much resistance from the authorities in making the film?
We wrote and telephoned, both myself and also members of my production team in Louisiana, many, many times to try and get the Angola prison authorities to allow us to come and film in the prison, which they resisted. They said no. They just said they weren't interested in having anybody film anything to do with this case for a number of reasons, but one of which involved the press office saying, every time there's any publicity about these people, people send money to them. They really didn't want to do it. And then one of the members of my production team managed to persuade them to allow us to film for 1 hour outside the front gates.
Wow.
So they gave us that. And so because I couldn't get into Angola itself, I had to rely on shooting images in other Louisiana prisons to get abstract images of things like doors opening and closing, the kind of images I've tried to use in the film to help create the atmosphere of what it must be like to be in Angola. And on the second shoot, we were about to go and film in the New Orleans Parish Prison for the sequence where Herman, Albert and Robert all met, you know, in the late 60s, because it was on what was called the Panther Tier in New Orleans Parish Prison that they all met. And we arrived with their agreement to film, and we went into the prison, and one of the officers said, would you wait there for a while? And they kept us waiting for an hour, two, three. They wouldn't let us bring in our equipment. Eventually they said, come back another day. And yet we'd been there and arranged to be there, and we'd been given permission. It was actually empty at that point because they were just finishing the refurbishments post-Katrina. And they didn't let us back. And slowly, as we tried to go into other prisons that week, we realized that quite clearly the word had been sent that we were not to be allowed in any prison in Louisiana, which is kind of ironic given that Louisiana has the highest per capita incarceration in the world, and I couldn't get into a single prison. So the case, is there something to hide that's more sinister than just the desire amongst prosecutors not to admit that they've made a mistake? Is there anything more sinister than basic conservatism? I don't know. I don't know. Why would they not, for example? At the time of the murder, there was a bloody fingerprint right by the body on one of the walls in the dormitory. It was proved that fingerprint did not belong to any of the people accused of the murder, including Herman and Albert. And given that the captive population of that prison have all been fingerprinted, why did they not check that fingerprint against the prison roll? And that's a serious question that they've never answered. Why would they not, given the most important piece of forensic evidence by the body, not check it against every single prisoner in the prison, if they hadn't already decided who they thought was guilty of this crime?
In the film, there was numerous interviews with people that have been involved in the case. Ex-prison guards and the current Attorney General, they're all very much convinced of the guilt of Herbert and Albert. One person that definitely doesn't is the widow of Brent Miller, and she is very, very much convinced of their innocence.
Yes. I mean, Tini is an amazing woman. She was widowed at 17 by this crime, and I think had never been presented with any of the evidence. I mean, as she says in the film, you know, she couldn't go to any of the court hearings. It would have been too much for her. A young girl, you know, the love of her life taken from her, and it's the most understandable thing in the world that she would, you know, she's been dealing with it for 37 years. And I think it's entirely understandable that she would never have seen the evidence, you know, with the weight of her family and her in-laws, obviously, you know, grieving terribly. I think it's one of the most understandable things you could possibly imagine. I think it was only when she was presented with the evidence years later, in the last, I think, 3 or 4 years, that she began to ask the same questions that I've asked. You know, Fatini, the biggest question for her is, why didn't they find out who the fingerprint belonged to? She's been denied the justice of knowing who really killed her husband by prison authorities who, you know, rushed to judgment. I look at it and I think, why won't they do it for her? Why are they not prepared to find out who really killed her husband? She's been incredibly brave to actually stand up and say, you know what, I don't think these guys did it. And she's done it on the basis of the evidence. I find it very difficult to accept that if some of those people have really looked at the cases and really read the transcripts and looked at the nature of the testimony of so many of those prison snitches, that they can still draw the conclusion that it was these two guys. Look at the evidence, is what I say.
We're virtually out of time, Vadim, but finish off, let's talk about what is the situation now? What's happening with Herbert and Albert today?
In September 2008, Albert's conviction was overturned by the federal court in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, which means he now has a presumption of innocence. But in U.S. law, the attorney general representing the state is allowed to contest that overturning.
Which means he's currently still incarcerated.
Absolutely. Now, in March 2008, Herman and Albert received a visit from Chairman John Conyers, who is the chair of the House Judiciary Committee in Washington. He had heard about their case and had come to the same conclusion that many people of us have, that this is a miscarriage of justice. So John Conyers visited the prison, and whatever he said to the prison administration, within, I think, a matter of weeks, Herman and Albert had been released from solitary confinement for the first time in 36 years into a high-security dormitory. I don't know what John Conyers said to them, but it obviously worked. However, in November that year, just 2 months after his conviction had been overturned, for reasons that have only been described to date as financial, Albert and Herman were put back into solitary confinement, where they still are today. So in the meantime, the Attorney General's office is contesting the overturning of Albert's conviction. Oral arguments in that case were heard in March 2009. So for a year, which I'm told by those that know in Louisiana, is an unprecedented length of time. Three judges have been considering the state's argument that he should not be released. So literally any day now, Albert could receive the news that he is either to be released or that the state will force a retrial. And so there he sits after 37 years in solitary confinement, waiting for those three judges in the federal court to consider whether or not the overturning needs to be tested in the court again or not.
We've been talking about, you know, this film is about a terrible miscarriage of justice, basically. But one of the things that I'm not sure if we've emphasised enough in this interview, and to finish off with, I think we should, is, as you just mentioned, they have been in solitary confinement for 37 years, yeah. Which, by any stretch of the imagination, must qualify as a cruel and unusual punishment.
And a cruel and unusual punishment as specifically forbidden in the Eighth Amendment of the US Constitution. And one of Congressman Conyers' main objections to what's happened to them is the fact that it's their situation flies in the face of what is a noble and important document. And I think one of the things that I think the prison is worried about is that, you know, President Obama has said there has to be an end to torture in America, in Guantanamo. And yet, tucked away in the middle of the Louisiana countryside, at the very end of a 25-mile-long road, there is this place where these two men have been kept in a 6-foot-by-9-foot cell, 23 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, with supposedly 90-day reviews of their solitary confinement, but where those reviews consist of them being told if they admit they committed the murder that they will be let out of solitary. And for 37 years, they've insisted that these two 60-year-old men are the most dangerous people in Louisiana, and therefore they need to keep them in solitary confinement. And that's unconstitutional. And that's why they should be released. And so they shouldn't just be released because they're innocent. They should be released because they have been subjected to the torture of solitary confinement, not just for crimes that they didn't commit, but because they should never have been, as human beings, treated in that way.
That's a perfect point for us to end on. Vadim, thanks very much for speaking to me today.
You've been listening to Little Adams. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website at littleadams.com. The Little Adams podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.